Today is Thursday, January 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted to hold President Donald Trump accountable for the riot at the Capitol last week.
He is a clear and present danger to the nation that we all love.
So, what's next?
Pelosi was asked earlier today. She was a little close-lipped about what was going to be happening exactly.
And learning to cope with isolation from hermits. We'll have these stories and more next. Members of the U.S. House of Representatives met on Capitol Hill Wednesday to discuss an article of impeachment against President Donald Trump. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi called the president a clear and present danger to the country and someone who needed to be removed from office.
We know that we face enemies of the Constitution. We know we experienced the insurrection that violated the sanctity of the people's capital and attempted to overturn the duly recorded will of the American people. And we know that the president of the United States incited this insurrection, this armed rebellion, against our common country. He must go. He is a clear and present danger to the nation that we all love. Since the presidential election in November, an election the president lost, he has repeatedly lied about the outcome, sowed self-serving doubt about democracy, and unconstitutionally sought to influence state officials to repeal reality. And then came that day of fire we all experienced. The president must be impeached, and I believe the president must be convicted by the Senate, a constitutional remedy that will ensure that the Republic will be safe from this man who was so resolutely determined to tear down the things that we hold dear and that hold us together.
House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy gave his party's response.
Make no mistake. Those who are responsible for Wednesday's chaos will be brought to justice. Which brings me to today's debate. I believe impeaching the president in such a short time frame would be a mistake. No investigations have been completed. No hearings have been held. What's more, the Senate has confirmed that no trial will begin until after President-elect Biden is sworn in. But here is what a vote to impeach would do. A vote to impeach would further divide this nation. A vote to impeach will further fan the flames of partisan division. Most Americans want neither inaction nor retribution. They want durable, bipartisan justice. That path is still available, but is not the path we are on today. That doesn't mean the president is free from fault. The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump. Accept his share of responsibility, quell the brewing unrest, and ensure President-elect Biden is able to successfully begin his term.
The president faced a single charge, incitement of insurrection. And when the debate period ended, House members cast their vote.
On this vote, the ayes are 232. The nays are 197. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Catherine Gibson reports for VOA from Capitol Hill and tells us this impeachment vote was not like the last one.
What everyone will be talking about are those 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach the president for a second time. Some may remember that in the last impeachment last year, there were no Republican votes for impeaching the president, but this was very different this time around. I think because so many House members saw this happen with their own eyes and felt that the president had indeed been involved in inciting that riot, that insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. A key part of that was the top-ranking Republican Liz Cheney coming out on Tuesday night and saying that Trump's actions were among the greatest betrayals ever by a U.S. president. That gave a lot of political cover for Republicans to make that yes vote and to say, look, we can't let this happen again.
What about the Republicans who voted no? You know, there was a long process of debates. And what was the general consensus as to their rationale for opposing impeachment?
I think what's fascinating is that there was not a general consensus for voting against impeachment, is that what we saw in the 2 hours of debate, whenever Republicans came up, they really approached this from a number of different angles. Some of them didn't even address the events of January 6th, like Representative Jim Jordan, who was running the debate for the Republican side, who said that this was a just another example of cancel culture from Democrats. To others, like Representative Michael McCaul, who is the top-ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, saying, look, we needed to have more evidence before us. I'm thinking that more will come out, and I even may regret this decision to vote no. To, of course, you know, Representative McCarthy, who we heard earlier, saying that he thinks that the president should be censured for his actions. So really a range of responses from Republicans on this one.
One of the messages that I heard during the debate was a call for unity and not participating in divisive practices, according to the Republicans. Did the Democrats have anything to respond to that argument?
Well, a lot of Democrats said that the first step towards unity was acknowledging that this riot had happened and put the lives of many House members in danger, and it endangered the electoral process itself. They said that that was, in simple terms, kind of, you know, walking away without acknowledging what had happened, and that you couldn't really have any discussion about unifying the country until we sorted out what exactly happened at the U.S. Capitol and what it meant for the bigger picture and strength of our democracy.
Now, the House votes to impeach and the trial takes place in the Senate. We have heard that Mitch McConnell is not going to bring back the Senate, which is in pro forma session now, before the 19th. Do we know what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is planning to do as her next step?
Pelosi was asked earlier today about her plans to transmit those articles of impeachment over to the U.S. Senate, which, of course, would trigger the beginning of that trial. She was a little close-lipped about what was going to be happening exactly. The expectation is that that article would be sent over relatively soon, within the next few days. Mitch McConnell is saying that any trial would not get started until the earliest at January 19th, when the Senate comes back into session. And of course, as we know, that's just a day before President-elect Biden's inauguration.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Following the adoption of the article of impeachment, U.S. President Donald Trump released a video statement denouncing violence.
My fellow Americans, I want to speak to you tonight about the troubling events of the past week. As I have said, the incursion of the U.S. Capitol struck at the very heart of our republic. It angered and appalled millions of Americans across the political spectrum. I want to be very clear. I unequivocally condemn the violence that we saw last week. Violence and vandalism have absolutely no place in our country and no place in our movement. Making America great again has always been about defending the rule of law, supporting the men and women of law enforcement, and upholding our nation's most sacred traditions and values. Mob violence goes against everything I believe in and everything our movement stands for. No true supporter of mine could ever endorse political violence.
The president made no mention of the vote in the House chamber just a short while before the video was released that resulted in him being the first president in American history to be impeached twice during his term in office. Now, ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration on January 20th, law enforcement and local government officials in Washington are implementing unprecedented security measures. They want to avoid the kind of massive security breach that happened last week when thousands of President Trump supporters stormed into the U.S. Capitol building. Patsy Whitaker-Swara has those details.
U.S. law enforcement agencies in charge of securing President-elect Joe Biden's January 20th presidential inauguration are determined to avoid a repeat of this scene. Last week's bloody siege by supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump. Tens of thousands National Guard troops from several states will be in Washington as early as end of this week. The city's Mayor Muriel Bowser said that Biden's inauguration poses unprecedented challenges, from the COVID-19 pandemic to extremist threats.
People coming to demonstrate peacefully are very different than the people we saw storm the Capitol the other day. And I think that it will be shown that those people were organized, trained people who went into that building.
On Tuesday, the Federal Bureau of Investigation said it has received 100,000 videos and pictures as tips and opened 160 case files in its probe of the siege.
To focus strictly on sedition charges, we're looking at and treating this just like a significant international counterterrorism or counterintelligence operation.
Cracking down on domestic terrorism presents unique legal challenges compared to fighting terrorists abroad.
You're dealing with Americans born and raised here who enjoy protections under the Constitution, and they know where that line starts and stops in terms of how far they can go before they get over into the criminal side of the activity.
Responding to VOA's question earlier this week, Biden said he is not afraid of taking his oath outside, as is the tradition in American inaugurations.
I think it's critically important that there be a real serious focus on holding those folks who engage in sedition and threaten people's lives, deface public property, cause great damage, that they be held accountable.
For weeks, authorities monitored online activities of right-wing extremists and white supremacists urging the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Now they are focusing on those planning for more violence leading up to or during the inauguration. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA plans to conduct what it calls a hot fire test of the core stage of its new Space Launch System, or SLS, on Saturday, January 16th. The SLS will be used by the space agency to send crew members and cargo on its Artemis missions to the moon and beyond. According to NASA, the core stage includes liquid hydrogen and oxygen tanks, four engines, and all related electronics and avionics. The test involves powering up all core stage systems, pumping more than 2.6 million liters of ultra-cold fuel into the tanks, and firing all four engines simultaneously to simulate the operation of the core stage during a launch. The space agency says Saturday's test will be the final test of this critical stage of the launch system. NASA plans to send the first woman and the next man to the moon in 2024. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A group of British lawmakers say the world's leading democracies should form a coalition to counter China's human rights abuses at home and its support for authoritarianism overseas. The China Research Group says Britain is in a desperate need of a coherent policy on China and recently published a self-styled policy toolkit. Henry Ridgewell takes it from here.
More than 50 pro-democracy activists were arrested earlier this month in Hong Kong, the latest crackdown by Beijing on political freedoms. So how can Western democracies respond to the challenge of an increasingly assertive China? British conservative lawmakers have set up the China Research Group to answer that question. Tom Tugendhat, chairman of Parliament's Foreign Affairs Select Committee, is co-founder of the group.
What we're trying to do is to encourage it to change within a rules-based international system so that the people of China have the opportunity that they deserve and so the rest of the world is not threatened.
It is a battle with global implications, says China analyst Steve Tsang.
China under Xi Jinping is interested in exporting and supporting authoritarianism in the world. So there is a bit of a contest of two different ideas, liberal democracies and Chinese supported authoritarianism.
Among the policy recommendations are the formation of a coalition of 10 leading democracies to counterbalance Chinese influence and sanctions against Chinese individuals accused of human rights abuses.
And we know about the mass sterilization and detention and indeed enslavement of Uyghur Muslims. We know about the persecution of Mongols in Inner Mongolia. We know about the persecution of Tibetans. And we now know very clearly about the repression of democratic rights in Hong Kong. And all of these should be met with sanctions.
The toolkit also recommends forcing greater legal obligations on foreign banks and financial institutions to prevent the erosion of Hong Kong's autonomy. But the West has limited leverage, argued Sang.
We are looking at some of the leading Western banking and financial institutions. So they will be the ones that will be hurt much more than the Chinese party state itself.
China is the biggest trading partner for the United States and Europe.
Actually, what we're seeing is not fair trade. It may be property, intellectual property theft. It may be effectively asset stripping.
But any policy toolkit will have limited impact, and global democracies must instead win the battle of ideas, argues Sang.
If we cannot win the arguments with reality of democracies, then we will not be able to outcompete China's approach to supporting authoritarianism.
To counter that support, the China Research Group wants Britain and its allies to go much further in exerting leverage on Beijing. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Turkey has been providing refuge for Uyghurs fleeing Chinese persecution, but Turkish rights groups are worried that the country's parliament is poised to pass an extradition treaty with China. Dorian Jones reports this also has alarmed the Uyghur community.
Every day, Medina Nazimi demonstrates with fellow Uyghurs outside Istanbul's Chinese consulate to protest a crackdown against the predominantly Muslim minority in China.
I haven't received any news from my sister for 4 years. I had heard she was taken into a detention camp by the Chinese government but released after 2 years. But then in 2019, she was arrested again on charges of separatism because she had studied at the university in Turkey.
For decades, Turkey has offered asylum to Uyghur refugees, including some wanted by China because they've been accused of terrorism. With the Turkish parliament considering an extradition agreement with China, human rights groups warn safe haven in Turkey could be threatened.
If this is approved in the parliament, we will be accepting a legal document that would put us into the position of being under obligation to extradite people to China without confirming if they committed a crime or not.
The extradition agreement comes amid deepening Turkish-Chinese economic and financial ties. China is also Turkey's leading supplier of COVID-19 vaccines. A delay in delivering vaccines was interpreted by some in Turkey as a prod by Beijing to press the Turkish parliament to expedite ratifying the extradition agreement. Alarmed, one Uyghur leader made an appeal on social media to Turkish society for support. Seyit Tümtürk told VOA there's been a positive response.
There have been very positive reactions that made us happy. Our Turkish brothers went to the homes of the Uyghur neighbors and said, this law will not pass in Turkey. We are here for you. If they pass it, they can extradite all of us to China with you. Can there be a more supportive reaction?
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu, perhaps mindful of strong backing for the Uyghur community among government supporters, has pledged no Uyghurs will be extradited to China. But such promises are doing little to abate Uyghur fears.
Because of the increase in economic and technological relations with China, I don't believe that Turkey is offering open support to Uyghurs anymore.
Until now, Turkey has been one of the strongest backers of the Uyghurs. But the fear among many Uyghurs is that pragmatism will usurp principle. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
South African telecoms company MTN Group says Uganda's communications regulator has ordered telecoms operators in the country to suspend all internet gateways from Wednesday evening until further notice. The blackout comes on the eve of a presidential election in which longtime leader Yoweri Museveni is facing an opposition galvanized by popular singer Bobi Wine, despite a campaign marked by brutal crackdowns. Ugandans reported difficulties accessing the internet via mobile devices and wireless connections on Wednesday evening. An internet monitor NetBlock said on Twitter that the country was experiencing a nationwide blackout from 1600 UTC. The internet ban comes a day after Uganda blocked all social media and messaging apps ahead of the vote, which the president says is in retaliation for Facebook taking down some pro-government accounts. And finally, for many, the COVID-19 pandemic has meant lockdowns, quarantines, and the lack of an active social life that have forced them to cope with being alone. It's a challenge that hermits and so-called spiritual solitaires have known well from ancient times through today. Now, to get some insight into the difficulties and spiritual satisfactions that near isolation can bring, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Karen Carper-Fredette, a former Catholic nun who has lived for decades on a North Carolina mountainside with her husband, Paul. Together, they run Raven's Bread Ministries, a website that supports and informs contemporary hermits and solitaires.
Even as a young girl, Karen Carper-Fredette was deeply drawn to the spiritual life. At the age of 17, she joined the Poor Clares, a Catholic contemplative order, as a nun. But after 30 years there, she concluded that for her, the intense communalism of monastery life prevented the direct and intimate contact with God that she craved.
And I began to realize that if I were to be focused and respond to what was deepest within me, I needed solitude where there was nobody. When there's nobody around, then you're freed from what other people expect of you and free to just live up to what God, the Holy, is calling you to.
Fredette left the monastery to live in solitude in a cabin deep in the West Virginia mountains, an experience that at first felt more like walking in the dark than living in the light. In her 1994 book, Where God Begins to Be, she cites a quote by Patrick Overton that she says continues to sustain her.
When you come to the edge of all the light that you have and you take a step into the darkness, one of two things will happen. Either you will find solid ground beneath your feet, or you will be taught to fly. What it means to me is that you walk in absolute trust. You live in the moment, and you begin to realize that, in truth, that's all we do have.
Fredette says she had to learn that lesson of trust during her first days of solitary prayer and meditation in that cabin. She had no safe drinking water or steady income. She was even unsure she would have enough food and firewood to survive the coming winter.
And I remember sitting in my prayer space, and I was totally terrified. And as I sat there, I heard a voice sort of deep within me, which said, well, do you have a roof over your head right now? Well, yes. Do you have enough to eat today? Yes. Do you actually have enough to eat tomorrow? Yes. What more do you need? What you need in the moment will be provided. That's the kind of trust that a hermit has to live with.
Fredette sees a connection between the hermit life and the forced isolation everyday non-hermits are experiencing during the pandemic. She offers this advice for so-called COVID solitaries who want to benefit spiritually from this moment.
You don't have to jump into the pool at the deepest end, but a person who's feeling the need for all kinds of distractions, if they deliberately give themselves a sacred space, simple, quiet for 15 minutes every day, they will find that even that 15 minutes will become so precious that you'll want half an hour. you may want to take an hour, and then you don't need so many words. We have to be patient, but it is a process that will take place almost without our following any special direction. It's a matter of getting in touch with your own self.
Her heart goes out to secular people who are coming to know aspects of themselves that were hidden during more normal, busier times. Indeed, Karen and Paul Fredette's website has been deluged with inquiries since a recent New York Times article about their way of life.
I am in touch with people in fear and people in pain and people angry in the past year. And if they're able, I suggest that we journal. We write down what we are feeling in the present moment. Feelings we need to be in touch with because they do not lie. They're the truth of who we are. And who we are is a very spiritual being.
To find out more about the work Karen Carper and Paul Fredette are doing to support contemporary hermits and those dealing with the spiritual challenges of COVID-era isolation, visit their website at www.ravensbreadministries.com and take it from there. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting our website. Just point your web browser to voanews.com on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device. And don't forget, with our top of the hour newscast, you can always be informed. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a tremendous Thursday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains committed to holding to account the Nicaraguan regime of Daniel Ortega by exposing those who suppress the democratic will of the Nicaraguan people. That's why the United States has imposed sanctions on Marvin Ramiro Aguiar Garcia, while Mauro Antonio Gutierrez Mercado and Fidel de Jesus Dominguez Alvarez. All three have enabled and benefited from the corrupt Nicaraguan regime. Marvin Ramiro Aguiar Garcia is the vice president of the Supreme Court of Justice, national political secretary of the Sandinista Leadership Council, and a member of the Council for the Administration and Judicial Career of the Nicaraguan Supreme Court of Justice, which ensures regime supporters are selected for key posts. As the national political secretary, Aguiar directly advises President Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo and reportedly coordinates the targeting of pro-democracy opposition members, while Mauro Antonio Gutierrez Mercado is a deputy of the National Assembly and president of the Production, Economic, and Budget Commission. He publicly advocated for the controversial foreign agents law, which specifies that individuals and entities in Nicaragua that receive foreign funds must register and make detailed monthly reports to the Interior Ministry. The law also prohibits such individuals and entities from participating in the political process. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said he anticipates that this law, which contemplates fines and other legal sanctions for noncompliance, will be invoked to restrict the civil and political rights of certain individuals or organizations that the government arbitrarily deems to be a threat. Fidel de Jesus Dominguez Alvarez, chief of the Nicaraguan National Police in León, has allegedly directed assaults on many Nicaraguan citizens and journalists. Dominguez reportedly directed the ransacking of an independent radio station and beating of a journalist by Nicaraguan National Police officials. Dominguez was also reportedly involved in the abuse and beatings of a former opposition deputy and other Ortega opponents. The United States government will continue to take the steps necessary to support the Nicaraguan people and pressure the Ortega regime to cease its repression, respect human rights, and allow the conditions for free and fair elections that would restore democracy to Nicaragua.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.